Can you tell us more about your study, how Latinos are doing in California?
Unfortunately, we found that Latinos do worse than their Latino counterparts in other states. It's largely due to a failing public educational system and also due to increased regulation, mostly environmental.
My guest today is Soledad Orsua, lead author of the study El Futuro es Latino, conducted with Chapman University, which looks at how Latinos are doing in California compared to other states when it comes to education, income, and homeownership. We also sit down with Gloria Romero, who's a former state senator. She's going to tell us what they found on the education side of things.
Only 36% of Latino students in California even meet or exceed the basic levels of proficiency in reading and writing. That is stunning.
We'll also talk to Marshall Toplansky, who's a clinical assistant professor at Chapman University. In this research, he looked at the Latino workforce in California. He's going to share with us his findings.
The largest number of truckers, laborers, construction, industries that are crucial to the growth of California in the future, we're going to need to rely on Latinos for the next generation of economic prosperity for the state.
I'm Siamak Kurami. Welcome to California Insider. Soledad, it's great to have you back on. Welcome back.
Thank you.
You have been doing a study on how Latinos are doing, along with Chapman University. Can you tell us more about your study, how Latinos are doing in California?
I've been working with Chapman University, and I was the lead author in our current project on El Futuro es Latino, where we took a look at how California Latinos are doing, how they compare with Latinos across the United States, and really what their future is here in California. Unfortunately, we found that Latinos do worse than their Latino counterparts in other states in terms of education, income, and home ownership. It's largely due to a failing public educational system and also due to increased regulation, mostly environmental. The environmental regulation is one that has decreased job opportunities while also increasing the values of homes, making home ownership largely unattainable for most Latinos today. First, we took a historical look at California, and it's important to realize that California history is Latino history. Today, we think of California as the fourth largest economy in the world, and we rarely ever think about how we got there. And so what we see is that World War II, the 1940s, was just an era of tremendous boom and opportunity in California. And we see that in California, all of the defense contractors were here, aerospace, manufacturing, and Latinos played a very pivotal role. They literally transitioned from field work to all of a sudden working in factories. I highlight some of my own family members who grew up picking cotton in the San Joaquin Valley and transitioned to factory work. This is my tia Anita, and this is my grandmother, Maria Luisa. So they grew up as little girls picking cotton, and eventually they transitioned to factory work. My tia Anita eventually started working for Lockheed Martin. She was soldering computer chips.
Wow.
So what we see is that the 40s, the 60s is just tremendous upward mobility for Latinos. Both all of my family members were homeowners in Pomona, where they had many of these industrial contracts there. And so we see it's potential, there's so much growth. But then unfortunately, the 1960s and 1970s also coincide with California's environmental movement. We see CEQA. Both CEQA and CARB are formed in the late 60s, early 1970s. And these are really the drivers of all environmental regulation that is used today. And eventually, by the 1990s, California becomes the leader in growth control. So at that point, we see that the manufacturing jobs in California are largely gone. And when we look for towards today, we see that many of these paths towards upward mobilities among Latinos, they're not there anymore. And so sadly, Latinos are facing a very tough decision. Their future is largely at risk in California.
And did you guys find a correlation between manufacturing jobs? Was the manufacturing jobs a pathway for Latinos to go upward?
Definitely. When you think about Los Angeles and even all of California, they became leaders in manufacturing in the 1970s. And so manufacturing is a very upwardly mobile job, especially for minorities such as Latinos, where we see them, you know, starting on entry-level jobs, eventually going into management and then starting their own companies. So this was just a tremendous era of opportunity for Latinos in California.
So essentially people starting with like manual labor work, and then they get good at that. And Latinos and hardworking people are reliable. So they come, they do the work, and then they learn, and then they go up.
And Latinos were basically the industrial workforce that was needed to sustain California's boom.
So you mentioned Sequoia and CARB. Back in the day, there's pictures of LA being like, you couldn't see the mountains. And these organizations, these regulations had some good impact, right?
Definitely. Everybody wants a clean environment. That's what is, you know, necessary. But what we see today, California has goals to reach net neutrality, zero carbon emissions. And so that is something that will directly impact Latinos. We took a look at just what jobs Latinos occupy nationally, and it's not surprising. They are largely in roles that are carbon producing. Those are construction, logistics, oil and gas. These are heavy carbon economy type jobs. And when we look at what's happening in California, we see again that Latinos are essentially overrepresented in these jobs. So in California, Latinos are the carbon economy. And these are the jobs that are most at risk of being phased out in order for California to, you know, reach some of its net neutral goals.
And are they getting phased out from what you guys studied, or is it when we hit the threshold when we're zero emission economy?
We are still on path for basically net zero by 2035. We took a look at some of the jobs that are really at risk, and we found that trucking was a really big one. When you look at how California compares to the rest of the nation, California has the largest number of Latinos in trucking. It's over 50%. So when you look at what CARB has done is, I believe beginning in 2035, all trucks in ports will be required to have an electric battery. So this is they're very expensive. They cost about $400,000. They're very heavy. They basically undermine the economics of a trucking industry or a trucking business. They take a long time to charge. And so what we see here is that it will be the big companies who are able to pivot and, you know, grow their business. It will be the small mom and pops that are largely not able to compete any longer. And, you know, just like manufacturing, what we found is it's surprising that trucking is actually a very upwardly mobile job. Many people think about the traditional trucker as being a white, blue-collar job, but that's not the case anymore. We're even seeing that more and more Latinas are getting into trucking. And one of the reasons it's so upwardly mobile is that people come in entry level, they can grow into management, then they eventually start running their own rigs and start their business. So just like the manufacturing jobs, this is an upwardly mobile job. It pays very well. Some have reported annual salaries of $80,000 a year. So this is a largely good job for entry level Latinos. And unfortunately, these are one of the jobs that are going to be impacted by pending legislation.
Latinos represent what I would call the carbon economy. They are the group of people that run the infrastructure. They're the largest number of truckers, the largest number of laborers, the largest percentage of composition for construction and other kinds of blue-collar industries. And so if we want to make this particular group successful, in addition to being able to educating the group for future occupations, we have to make their current lives more successful. So to do that, we need specifically to lighten up on some of the very strict environmental laws in order to be able to make it easier for Latinos to drive trucks, to create businesses, mobile businesses like taco trucks and restaurants. This is the core of that economy right now, and they're really not being accommodated with current state policy.
What did you guys find through your studies? How are Latinos economically and business-wise, how are they impacted in this state?
The first thing we found is that if you look at the occupations of Latinos, the highest concentrations of Hispanic workers are in industries like farming and forestry, which we kind of intuitively knew, but building and grounds maintenance, construction, food prep, transportation, 23% of all truck drivers in the United States are Hispanic. And if you look at that in terms of California, those numbers are actually close to triple. 71% of laborers and helpers, just basic laborers in California are Latino. 50% of the truck drivers, 60% almost of the manufacturing workers, 61% of the construction workers. So Latinos are represented at twice or higher the rate of in California than they are elsewhere. So this is a very important aspect of what we found, because these are industries that are crucial to the growth of California in the future. And if they're so heavily dominated by Latinos, and we want to incent Latino entrepreneurship, what do we need to do to make this environment more friendly for them?
Did your study find what we need to do to fix that?
The study suggests several important areas. First is government policy. We need to be able to recognize that we have a group of people that doesn't necessarily have a lot of wealth already created. So we need to find incentive programs to be able to help Latinos continue to make strides in the entrepreneurial area. We need to lighten up on environmental regulations to allow Latinos to be able to get in to restaurants, to taco trucks, to driving their own trucks that service the economy, and not have to go to the tremendous expense of investing in electric trucks and things like that until they're successfully implanted and up and running in the existing economy. So those are two areas, plus the educational side. We're having a tremendous problem with educational attainment, both in the reading and the math skills of Latinos, which is significantly lower than the rest of the California community. We need to be able to create programs that are going to help them move forward.
Soledad, you mentioned that your family members that came here, they were both able to buy their own homes. Can you tell us what's going on right now for Latinos in homeownership here in California?
Nationally speaking, 51% of Latinos own their own home. But in California, they do much worse. In California, it's only 46% Latino homeownership. So what we're finding is that Latinos in other states do much better. For instance, the best state is New Mexico, where it's a 70% homeownership rate. So that's very striking. We see that in Texas and Florida, they also do much better. In Texas, the homeownership rate is 59%, and in Florida, it's 55%. And when you ask, you know, what's going on, the reason here is really the cost of living. And so that just makes the opportunity for homeownership just largely unattainable for most.
Because people have to have a lot of money to put the down payment, and it's expensive, the housing cost.
Well, when we look at sort of workers, you know, any savings in income is just gobbled up by some of these high costs of living, the highest utility rates, highest gasoline. So that is largely what is keeping homeownership unattainable.
And we have been told by some experts that a lot of times people that drive the most might be the Latinos, because they're doing the landscaping jobs or they're living in certain areas that might be outside of big metropolitan areas, like maybe further away, and they have to drive more or they have to use their conditioning more because they're out of kind of further away from the coast. Is that true?
Yeah, and interestingly, what we found is that Latinos might be voting with their feet. When we looked at all 26 of the metropolitan statistical areas, all of them grew in terms of Latino population, except San Jose. That had a reduction. But we found that Riverside and San Bernardino had the largest increase in Latino population. And one of the reasons is because people want single-family homes. So we see that the homeownership rate in San Bernardino, Riverside counties is much higher. It's nearly 61%. So that's very different from low homeownership rates such as Los Angeles, which are 35%. So what does this tell us? It means that the Latino dream is homeownership. And homeownership is largely unaffordable in coastal areas. So we see Latinos moving towards the inland counties where there is opportunity, there is upward mobility, and they can afford a home.
Folks, you've probably been hearing me talk about Verify for a while now. Verify has been getting a ton of phone calls from you, and I thank you for supporting an investment that actually helps people. A lot of people are talking about this investment, and I'd like to review the basics with you. First off, yes, it's true. You can earn up to 10.25% fixed rate of return that's not correlated to the stock market or to the Fed. You can turn your income on or off, compounded, whatever you choose, and there are absolutely no fees. There are no restrictions on your principal if you ever need your money back, and you'll get your monthly statement with no surprises. If you are not sure if you can trust this economy, this secure collateralized portfolio may be a very good option for you. Just go to investyrefi.com. That's invest, the letter Y, then refi.com. Folks, I take my endorsements very seriously. If you're looking for a solid investment that helps people, contact my friends at YRefi and then tell them Siamak Karami sent you. Now let's go back to the interview. And you mentioned that you guys looked into education. And, you know, we have been covering education on the show, and we're facing some challenges in California. Can you tell us what's the impact, what's happening with education?
Well, when you think about upward mobility, getting a good education is, you know, what sounds like the obvious choice. But when we looked at California, it was really sad to just see systemic failure across the map. We actually created a heat map, a map of distress of failing schools. And what you see in our report is that it's just across the board. So unfortunately for Latinos, public education is not a way for upward mobility anymore.
We're going to sit down with Gloria to talk about education and get her insights on this. Can you tell us what's going on?
Well, thank you. And I just so happen to have a copy of the report here. This is being done by Chapman University, and I'm very honored that they invited me to write the piece on education and the Latino community. And so what is happening basically is, to some extent, the same old, same old. It is another report basically showing that in California, we are still shortchanging Latino students when it comes to education. So I'm not surprised by the outcome. The question is, again, what do we do with the report? And that, to me, is where the next steps will be, and I'm happy to be participating in this. You know, unlike many reports, you just write a report, you send it out, it sits on a bookshelf somewhere. Somebody says, I read the report, okay, fine. And then in 10 or 20 years, you come back and you read another report that says the same thing. What Chapman University and the Latino Project are trying to do is to say, let's issue the report, but let's really have a conversation about this, and not just with the bureaucrats, not just with those who wrote the reports, but let's take it out to the business world, to the chambers of commerce, to the churches, to family groups, to neighborhood watch groups, and talk with them about what are the implications of this report. And that phase of the report beyond the writing, to me, is what's very interesting. So I'm honored to be a part of this.
Do you think Latinos really know that this is the situation compared to the past? Were you surprised by the results of this report?
I'm not surprised by the results, because when I was the chair of the Education Committee in the California State Senate, and for years, and having started independent charter schools, I have done so because I know not only that Latino students are being shortchanged, but in reality, every California student is being shortchanged by the public education system that California now offers. So I myself am not surprised, and that's why I have been for years now been ringing the bell and talking about education and ways that we can, if we can ever overcome the political obstacles, to bring about true parental school choice in California and make changes. So with respect to Latinos, do Latinos know about this? To some extent, I think that many parents are waking up. We saw certainly during the pandemic, and this was an unintended outcome, where many parents, because of Zoom, right, and having to watch education online when the schools were ordered closed, parents started talking to each other, then banding with others, began to take a look at an understanding. And in the meantime, with all this money that we're paying into education, my kid still can't really read well. My kid is not writing well. My kid is not computing well. What does it all mean? So we began to see a rise of a homeschooling movement, sort of a mass movement out of the public, the traditional public education systems, and choosing charter schools or magnet schools or whatever else they might choose. So it's kind of exciting there. So in that sense, to go back to your question, I think while many parents may not have the specifics of what the percentages are and what it means, a lot of them have sort of this understanding that all is not well in Denmark. There's something wrong in the education system, and my student is a manifestation of that. So parents are knowing, are waking up, and the statistics, not only in this report, but really, I could look at this report to the reports from 30 or 40 years ago, are saying the same things. We have a massive failure in the way we do public education here in California.
This is something that, from what we're gathering, a lot of people want improved, because every time there is a ballot measure or anything has to do with giving money to schools, Californians always vote for it. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think people vote for it largely because they can identify with it. You know, most parents will find and know what their local public school is. Most parents will know who their teacher is of their child. They may not know who their mayor is, their city council member, their supervisor, their senator. They probably know who the president is, the vice president. They don't know who, after that, they don't know who the rest of them are. A teacher you meet on a daily basis. So there's a lot of affinity towards a teacher. You know, teachers basically, like firefighters, are considered to be, you know, the good guys. You know them, they know your name. And I believe that most people believe teachers are trying to do the right thing. So I think most teachers want to make a difference in a kid's life. It's not about the teachers when I make a critique of education. It's about the system and how we set it up. And even teachers themselves get shortchanged in a profession that's offered in a way that doesn't even recognize their professionalism. So parents get pulled into this and want to do the right thing because we believe in education. You know, that line that education is the key to the American dream, I believe that most parents believe that. They want to see their kids do better than what they themselves have had an opportunity to have and to succeed.
Is there a difference, the education opportunity from where you were growing up compared to now?
I have actually different thoughts on it. On one hand, I graduated in the 70s, okay, from high school. At that time, my high school teacher told me, literally, that college was not for me. I had to argue with my high school counselor to even get an application to go to college, to apply to a college. I had no idea even what is college, except that I knew that this was something out there. So have times changed? Absolutely. I mean, today there's a lot of discussion about education, about college going. There's very different encouragement. There are workshops to support. That's all good and great. On the other hand, if I look at the statistics of performance, we still find today, for example, looking at Latino students, we find today, and this is just the most recent data based on testing outcomes in the state of California. When it comes to reading, writing, basically we find that only 36% of Latino students in California even meet or exceed the basic levels of proficiency in reading and writing. 36%. That is stunning. And it's even worse when we look at mathematics. In mathematics for Latino students, as of the most recent test, it's only 23%. So what does that mean? It basically means that some, like 80% of Latino students, forget about becoming an astronaut, a doctor, a physician. You can't do basic math. When it comes to reading or writing, how do you become the teacher that we all love when you can't pass basic reading? And this, you know, from my own background, was what largely inspired me to ultimately run for the state legislature, because by that time, I was a college professor. I taught at Cal State LA. This is a working class college. This is a college located in the heart of East LA, the San Gabriel Valley, where basically students who come, they're not full-time students. They're not the legacy students. They're not the rich students. These are largely first-generation college students, meaning that just like me, their parents had never probably graduated from high school, had never gone to college. They were the first generation, and they are the first generation of college students, doing everything right, graduating from their high schools, coming, basically crossing the freeway, getting to Cal State LA, and then sitting in my classroom finding out they can't write. So it was very interesting to me to begin to see that that price that we pay in the elementary and middle schools and high schools, the failure, the shortchanging of Latino students, it crosses over when you get to college because you bring the same lack of skills. So how do we go forward from there? How do we progress? So I began to be very interested in this topic as a professor, seeing that once these kids came from high schools, you know, and these were the kids that were able to graduate and able to get into college, they were still failing because they couldn't write. And we know from the studies that we've done that if you're not reading by basically age 9, you basically are being set up for a career of failure if you cannot read by the age of 9. That's why a lot of the testing will take a look at early education, because when you're reading, it's comprehension. Reading is not just reading, it's writing, it's articulating skills. So much is bound in that.
Why are so many people leaving California? It wasn't long ago, people from everywhere wanted to move to the Golden State to enjoy a better life. Sadly, the standard of living has been dropping in the past decade. Are you like me and wonder why this is happening? I'm Siamak Karami, host of California Insider. In our film, Leaving California, The Untold Story, I take you an intimate journey of love, loss, tragedy, and hope as residents face the prospect of leaving their beloved state. Everyday people like you tell their stories about why they have to move out of the state even though they don't want to. Experts and policymakers also give insights about what's happening behind the scenes. Together, we get to the root cause of this exodus. Go to leavingcalifornia.com to view the first 15 minutes of the film for free. By watching Leaving California, you can be part of the solution. Again, go to leavingcalifornia.com. Now, Gloria, some of our audience have told us that when we talk about black and brown kids like not doing well at school, it should come from the family. What are your thoughts? Do you think the Latino families, based on your experience, do they care about the education of their kids?
Parents are the first teachers. They're the most important teachers. Parents must be a vital part of this, absolutely. My mother had a sixth grade level of education, and yet she was probably one of the most important persons who influenced my desire to get an education. She would go to the school, and oftentimes she felt embarrassed because she didn't speak well, she didn't wear nice clothes, but she understood you go to the parent-teacher conferences, you stand there. She still didn't really understand everything, but she would, at home, she was a homemaker, she would clear the kitchen table and say, you sit there while she's making dinner, and we didn't have private desks or anything like that. We didn't have all these fancy things. You had the kitchen table, and while she's making the beans and the tortillas and all of the good food we were going to have later on, I and my siblings, and there were six of us, we had a piece of the green table in the kitchen where we would do our homework. But you know what? She oversaw that. She didn't understand it, but she oversaw it. We had a few books in our home. One of them was the Bible. One of them was Little Women. One of them was, again, to the tales of the Hopi Indians of New Mexico. I remember some of the books we had in the home. And I would read these over and over. And then my mother would take us to the library because my father would say he didn't like us to buy books because you can't eat books. And money was scarce. But there was a library. That's why to this day, I don't care what we vote for, but every time I see a bond measure for libraries, I will always support that, because that truly is, to me, the best school. And so when I go back and I look at it, the families, I think absolutely. And I was fortunate to have mother and father at home. My father worked. They valued, you know, making sure that we honored our country, that we respected the law, that we respected our family, you respect your teachers, and they would save time for us. My father worked graveyard. He would come home at 11 o'clock at night, and sometimes we were still working, doing homework. He would always, after hours of working in the high desert, Barstow, California, where it gets hot, after a long hour, he would come back, his lunch pail, his overalls, grease from working underneath the trains. He never turned us away when we were doing homework, and he would say, "Tell me what you're doing." And so that's what we need. And I was so fortunate to have a mother and father in my home. Many kids do not have mothers and fathers, but we have a mother, a father, a tia, a grandmother, somebody who can function. We need that. We need to have the parents. And so, yes, too many families will say, "I don't have time," or there can be dysfunctional families. But overall, I do believe from what I've seen that most parents genuinely care. Many parents just don't know how to navigate the system. That doesn't mean that the schools are off the hook. Because a lot of school districts will say, "Oh, well, it's the parent. The parents are bad." It begins with parents. But then we trust the district to say then, "Okay, we are sending our kids to you for the instruction, for the guidance, for the resources, for the curriculum, the education that we are paying for." Because I don't expect parents to say, "I'm going to walk you through, you know, world history or calculus or whatever we're studying at the time." But parents are the foundation. And so it begins there. And with parents then, for the parents to be able to speak up and say, "I support this, I don't support this," and then to give parents the rights to say, "If I don't like what I see in my school district, I'm out of here. I'm going to go to a charter school, I'm going to go to a magnet school, I'm going to homeschool." Or like in other states, we have begun to see more and more the creation of, you know, vouchers, opportunity scholarships, where parents can actually take the money that normally would go to the district automatically and just say, "No, I'm going to gather this bank account and I'm going to take this money to the school of my choice." In the Latino Project, the report, we did something very exciting and we're still working on it. And basically, what we've developed, and it's just been a lot of fun to actually talk about it. Like, I threw out these statistics, 36%, 23%, all these numbers. After a while, you forget it. So what we said is, okay, what would happen if we were to put like a map and show a heat map and to show the progress or the lack of progress when it comes to meeting the minimum standards, when it comes to reading, or the minimum standards when it comes to mathematics. Let's actually post it all at one time, every school in the state of California. Because right now, nobody knows. If you go to your neighborhood school, most people have no idea how well this school is doing, how well your child is doing. People don't know. They have no understanding of this. And so we're gonna create this map to see how well is this school doing in educating my child. And if I like the answer, okay, I'll stay there. And if I don't like the answer, maybe I will say, "I'm gonna find a charter school," or "Let me go to a different school or a different district," or "Maybe I'll homeschool." But we have to get this information into the hands of parents. And that's why with this Latino Project, this is one of the areas that I'm most excited about, because I don't want people just to hear me talk about and give numbers. I want them to actually see it and to say, "Oh my God, here's my school, basically 20% proficient in math. But if I go 2 miles, this school might have maybe 40%, which still isn't great, but it's a lot better than 20%. And once you start seeing it, it's a different discussion. And with this Latino Project that we're doing and wanting to go out, that's part of what we want to do. And it's based on experiences I've had where I've talked to parents about this. They kind of have a general feeling, "I know my kid's not doing that well," but when they see what is happening, it's a whole different reality. And I want people to realize that.
So that since you guys actually looked into this and you found there's a gap between what Latinos were doing before, how they were doing in California, and how they're doing now, or the future prospects for them, did you guys come up with any potential solutions?
Well, one thing we've noticed is that despite increased voter turnout, Latinos are still not participating enough. Even in the last election in 2020, there were nearly 4 million eligible voting age Latinos who did not vote. And so this is a serious problem. Latinos must start paying attention to what's happening. They must vote in their own economic interest, because what this report suggests is that Latino elected officials are not actually advancing a policy that promotes upward mobility among Latinos. So the future of California largely rests in its Latino population, and it will really be up to them to decide the future of California. What we're seeing is that el futuro es Latino, and so we really don't know what the future will be. If Latinos do well, California will do well.
Now, do you have any other thoughts for our audience?
Well, I invite you to read our report. We cover quite a bit of topics and engage with us. We're also planning to do events in different communities to really present our findings directly to the Latino community.
Soledad Orsua, lead author of El Futuro es Latino. It was great to have you on California Insider.
Thank you so much.
We have an exciting news for you. At California Insider, we created a new product. It's called California Insider Opinion. This is where our insiders and experts across the state are actually telling you what's going on behind the headlines. When there's a breaking news, a big issue, important issue happening in California, they're going to come on the screen and tell you what's happening behind the scenes. And these are like 7 to 10 minutes of opinion formats, where the guests are talking to the camera directly, telling you what's happening.
You're paying a tax increase of tens of thousands of dollars every year as a condition of keeping what you already own.
Make sure to look at the description below, because you want to sign up on our newsletter, because a lot of these opinions might be very sensitive that some people in the social media platform may not like. So we're putting them in the newsletter on our website so you can have them. These opinions will actually help you understand the political and policy landscape of California. We highly recommend you follow it.